Good morning. Thank you for joining Torah in Motion's eTIM 2022 Spring Series. We're so fortunate to be learning with Rabbi Dr. Martin Lakshin this morning for the first in his six-part series, After the Ten Commandments, the Laws of the Covenant Code. Rabbi Dr. Martin Lakshin is University Professor Emeritus at York University and now resides in Jerusalem. He received his PhD in Near Eastern and Judaic Studies from Brandeis University and his rabbinic ordination in Eretz Yisrael while studying at Yeshivat Merkaz HaRav Kook. Among Dr. Lakshin's publications is his four-volume translation and annotation of the Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. And we're so fortunate to have him with us here today that I will stop talking and let him start talking. So thank you. Take it away, Dr. Lakshin.
Thank you very much for that very nice introduction. It's wonderful to see so many familiar faces, and it's also nice to see some faces that I don't recognize, and I look forward to us studying together. Let me give you a word of warning in the beginning. Anybody who is interested in a Torah class where we go through texts really quickly and get through a lot of texts, well, let me tell you that you've come to the wrong class. I'm not sure we're going to finish the first verse of the section that we're going to be talking about today. Maybe we will, but I think the odds are not good. I think we're going to spend a while on the first verse of Parshat Mishpatim, and that's the style that I like to teach involves reading a lot of commentaries and trying to understand the ways in which the different commentaries struggled with the biblical text, because I happen to think that we can learn a lot from the writings of the medieval Jewish commentators. We'll also be looking at the text itself through our own eyes and considering various historical questions related to the text. Everybody is muted here. At the end, people will be unmuted. I probably will not be looking at the chat during the class, but towards the end of the class, I will look at the questions that you have put on the chat. I'm not great at multitasking and looking at the chat at the same time that I'm teaching. So right now, I think that it's time to just open the text and start studying together. I call this class After the Ten Commandments because, you know, when you think about it, when you look at the Torah begins with creation, and then everything is a continuing narrative. There's a historical narrative. Whether you believe that that everything that is written there is historical fact or isn't historical fact, however you relate to the text, it's a continuous narrative telling the story of the creation of the family, creation of the world, the creation of the family of Abraham, the creation of the Hebrews, the creation of the Israelites, the story of the slavery in Egypt, the exodus from Egypt. They come out of Egypt, they go to Mount Sinai, and they receive the Ten Commandments from God. And then that seems to be the end of this historical continuation that has been going on throughout this text. I'll just say one word about the phrase, the Ten Commandments. I actually prefer not using the term Ten Commandments. Those of you who know Hebrew know that in Hebrew, what we call the Ten Commandments in English are referred to in biblical Hebrew as Aseret HaDvarim, and in post-biblical Hebrew, it's referred to as Aseret HaDibrot, and probably the better title for what we call the Ten Commandments is the Decalogue. The only reason I hesitate to use the word Decalogue is because not everybody knows what that term means, but the Decalogue really means the 10 sayings. Now, it's not clear that each of the 10, what we call the 10 commandments, is actually a commandment, and certainly the first one, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. That's hard to describe that as being a commandment. And in fact, some of the commandments include some of what we call the second commandment, includes many different commandments. Lo tishtachaveh lahem velo ta'ovdeim, don't bow down to them, don't worship them. There are multiple commandments there. Well, let's think about what happens immediately after the story of the Decalogue. So the first thing that happens in chapter 20, this is before the text that we are really beginning with, which is chapter 21. The first thing that happens is just like finishing off the story of the giving of the Decalogue, the giving of the Ten Commandments. And the text gets across to us that people were very afraid of what they saw. I'll read it in the English. For those of you who can, should follow along in the Hebrew. All the people witnessed the thunder and the lightning and the blare of the horn and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they fell back and they stood at a distance. They were afraid, as we shall see from the continuation. I highlighted in the Hebrew side that phrase, ro'im et hakolot, because it is a very unusual phrase. You can see how the JPS translation tried to smooth over the difficulty of this phrase by translating it as they witnessed the thunder and the lightning. Really, it means that they saw the voices, they saw the mixing of the different senses together, the sense of sight and the sense of hearing. But whatever that phrase means, it gets across very clearly that people were afraid. And they said to Moses, you speak to us and we will obey, but let not God speak to us lest we die. Okay, we now heard the voice of God delivering the Decalogue, delivering the Ten Commandments to us. That's the last we want to hear of this direct relationship with God. We would prefer for you to be the intermediary from now on, is what they said to Moshe. Moses answered the people. This is one of my favorite verses in the Bible, actually, coming up here. Moses answered the people, be not afraid, for God has come and only in order to test you, and in order that the fear of him may be ever with you so that you do not go astray. What I like about this verse is the contradiction between the beginning of the verse and the end of the verse. The beginning of the verse says, Al tirau, don't be afraid. And then it says, well, the whole purpose of this whole thing was that you should be afraid. the fear of God should forever be with you. Now, I think we all understand that what Moshe is saying is don't be afraid of these phenomena of nature, of this, the voices that you heard, the thunder, the lightning, the shofar. Don't be afraid of those things. What you should be afraid of is to be afraid of God. There's quite a literature about what the phrase Yirat Elohim, fear of God, actually means. There are many scholars who have suggested that the phrase Yirat Elohim really means reverence for God, and it doesn't mean fear of God. For those of you who are interested, I actually wrote an article about this in the last couple of years. In the middle of COVID, a lot of people were talking. I guess COVID isn't totally over yet, but in the middle of the worst days of COVID, people were talking a lot about fear. And if you just Google Lakshan, a lion roars, who is not afraid? That's the name of the article. You'll find the article if you want to read it. If you can't find it, just send me an email, lakshan@yorku.ca, and I'll send you the article if you're interested in a discussion of what fear actually means in the Bible. This plan, the people came up with this plan. They didn't want to have this direct relationship. That's such an interesting thing that people were afraid of of having a direct kind of relationship with God. And they preferred doing it through the intermediary. And so Moshe goes back into the thick cloud where God was, Asher Sham HaElohim, while the people stayed at a distance. Okay, so that's the first thing that we see after the Decalogue. The second thing that we see after the Decalogue, again, this is before we reach the text that we're actually going to be concentrating on Parshat Mishpatim, on the covenant code in chapters 21 and following. So here's the end of chapter 20. And for those of you who can follow along on the Hebrew side, you'll see that I actually put in the Ta'amei Mikra, the cancellation signs into the text here, because I wanted to say something about the cancellation signs here. The Lord said to Moses, thus shall you say to the Israelites, you yourself saw that I spoke to you from the very heavens. Okay, so you didn't want to continue this, what was happening here. You asked that there should be a change, but in the meantime, you did witness all of this yourselves. With me, therefore, you shall not make any gods of silver, nor shall you make for yourself any gods of gold. I'll come back to that verse. Maybe I'll just read through the whole section. Make for me an altar of earth and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your sacrifices of well-being, your sheep and your oxen, and every place where I cause my name to be mentioned, I will come to you and bless you. And if you make for me an altar of stones, do not build it of hewn stones, for by wielding your tool upon them, you have profaned them. And do not ascend my altar by steps, that your nakedness may not be exposed upon it. We have a series of laws here that relate to the worship of God. First of all, making the point about the exclusivity of the worship of God, and then making points about what kind of altars should be built. And it seems like the text is suggesting that the ideal altar is an altar that is just made of earth. But if you're going to make a stone altar, there are various rules that apply to it. And then just the practical advice that the service should be conducted in such a way that the dignity and the modesty of the priests who are conducting the service will be preserved. It might seem like a very strange law to finish off this chapter, but when we recall that in many places in antiquity, there was a relationship between the cult in the temple and sometimes various things like cult prostitution and things of this nature, where the connection between sexuality and worship of gods. There's even a famous line in the Gemara that says, "Lo avdu bnei Israel avodah zarah ela kedei lahatir lahem arayot befar hesya." That the only reason that the Israelites were attracted to polytheism, to idolatry, is because the worship, this polytheistic worship, had various elements of sexuality, including sometimes public sexual acts that were part of the service. And so there's, I would say that the last law here is trying to totally distance the worship of God from what was going on in many cultures around the Israelites. Just because I know that there are a few people who show up here who are actually interested in cancellation signs. Those of you who aren't, the point won't take too long. If you look at the Hebrew there, of verse Yud Tet, it's strange that it begins Lo ta'asu niti, and it finishes Lo ta'asu lachem. Don't make is written twice in the verse, and the simplest way of understanding this verse, it seems that the pshat of this verse is that the verse is more or less, it's semi-poetic. Lo ta'asun iti Elohei chesed. That's the first half of the verse. Don't make along with me any gods of silver. And then the second stick of the poetic line is Velohei Zahav lo ta'asu lachem, and don't make any gods of gold for yourselves. I simply point out here that for very hard to figure out reasons, that is not how the Masoretes decided to punctuate the verse. Instead of having the Adnachta, the major stop in the verse, be after Elohei Chesef, and that's what your English translation here, the JPS translation, translated according to the understanding that I suggested. With me, therefore, you shall not make any gods of silver, statement number one, nor shall you make for yourselves any gods of gold. That phrase, lo ta'asun iti, was understood in very old Midrashim as a rule that Jews are not allowed to worship any of the other forces of heaven. You know, if you believe in angels or something like that, that the ET, those things that are with me, God has said, by highlighting it, by making those three phrases, those three words, sorry, be a phrase in and of itself, then the text is suggesting that the limit of worship has to be to God himself and not to anything that is allegedly like there together with God. Okay, so why are these verses here at the end of chapter 20? It seems as if they are expanding on the first or the second commandments, if you call them commandments, of the Ten Commandments of the Decalogue, which said, I, the Lord, am your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods besides me. You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. And the verse continues. I'm sure most of you know the continuation, because I am a jealous or a zealous God. You can't worship anything else other than me. I was noticing as I was preparing this class that the text doesn't say anywhere, please worship me. It's clearly implied. I am a jealous God. I'm a zealous God. It's saying, don't bow down to them. Don't serve them. But the implication is, of course, and you should be serving me. And so this text that we saw that shows up right at the end of the chapter, that gives you some instructions. And here are the ways in which you should be serving God. You should be worshiping God, can easily be seen as being a continuation of the beginning of the Ten Commandments. So, to sum up, the texts that show up here right after the Decalogue, right after the Ten Commandments, one of them is a text describing the reaction of the people to the experience of the Ten Commandments being given to them. The second one is a kind of expansion on the idea of worshiping God. Well, what does it mean to worship God? These are the first instructions that the Israelites receive, at least if we take the order in which the Torah is written. These are the first instructions of what it means to be worshiping God. Here's how you do it. You don't have any gold. You don't have any silver. You don't have anything aside from me. Here's the kind of altar that you should have. And be sure that there's modesty in the place in which you are worshiping God. Okay, so we can see how the end of chapter 20 is a logical continuation of the beginning of chapter 20, which was the Decalogue, which was the Ten Commandments. And then after we finish with that, we get to the text with which we are beginning, Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasin lifnehem ki tikne eved ivri shesh shanim yavod. These are the rules that you shall set before them. When you acquire a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, and then he goes free after those 6 years. So the question is, what is this corpus of laws doing at this precise point in the text? Commentators like Rashi and other of the medieval commentators like to discuss issues like this. Like, what is the connection? We have one text following another text. They don't seem to be connected to each other. I'm sure that most of you know, and if you don't know, you will find out in this course. Most of these mishpatim are civil laws. Why are civil laws coming up? The rules about goring oxes, rules about what happens if one person commits a tort against another person, rules of what happens when an animal injures a human being. Why are specifically these laws showing up at this point in the text? So Rashi takes a crack at creating various connections between chapter 21 and the previous chapter. And he makes an interesting comment here. He says, whenever Ele, these are, is written, a new subject begins. When, however, the Ele, and these are, is written, it is a continuation of the former subject. When you think about it, this is actually a pretty good point, pretty solid, unarguable point. If you write, these are the laws, then that could be the beginning of a section. But since it says here, ve'ele ha-mishpatim, Rashi is saying that there's an attempt of the Torah to establish a very strong connection between this these laws coming up here between chapter 21 and chapter 20. What is the connection? And these are the law. Here we are to interpret, and these are the laws. It's teaching that just as the former commandments were given at Mount Sinai, so these two were given at Mount Sinai. So you shouldn't think that this is different. Although we just saw that the experience of the Israelites had changed. The Israelites had heard directly, according to Exodus chapter 20, they heard the Ten Commandments directly from God, and then they didn't want to continue that. But it's been clear that even though these laws were not pronounced by God to the entire people, they came from God, and they came from Mount Sinai. And Rashi tries yet another way of establishing a connection between chapter 21 and chapter 20. V'lama nismacha parshat dinim l'farshat mizbeach. Why do these laws about these civil laws immediately follow the laws about making an altar? That was the last laws that we saw in chapter 20. To tell you that you should seek the Sanhedrin in the vicinity of the temple. Very interesting idea that the court of justice should be connected to the religious system. The temple is the center of the religion. And you might think, especially if you were an American and you believed in the separation of the various forms of adjudication, that it would be good not to have this, that it would be good to have a separation between the court system and the religious system. Well, Rashi says, and we will see another comment of Rashi in the continuation where he continues this idea, that there should be a strong connection between these things. You may or may not like Rashi's reading of Ve'ele HaMishpatim, of the the importance of the Vav here, I will just share with you that there was one famous Jew in history who really did not like this comment of Rashi, and who began his commentary on Exodus chapter 21 by writing a little ditty in Hebrew. Ibn Ezra, who had a lot of trouble with Rashi. And Ibn Ezra, for those of you who don't know, he was a very proud Spanish Jew, was proud of the culture of Spanish Jewry from the so-called golden age in Spain, and ended up living and writing for the last 20 or 25 years of his life in Ashkenazic countries and looking down on the Ashkenazim and looking down particularly on Rashi and other commentators who followed in the footsteps of Rashi. And so Ibn Ezra just begins his commentary here before he starts explaining anything. He writes this little poem that says, Asher, I'm sorry, that's a typo there. Asher noten lev lipshatim, gam baklalim gam bapratim, az yitbonen lama nichtav vav im ele hamishpatim. Someone who pays careful attention to pshat, both of larger units and smaller units, may then pose the question of why the letter Vav appears in the phrase, the Eile HaMishpatim. He's saying, come on, there are really important things to talk about in this text. And Rashi leads off his commentary with, why is there a Vav here? He's flabbergasted by the fact that this Ashkenazi thinks that that's the appropriate question to ask when you start reading the section called Mishpatim. Okay, now we'll see other attempts to establish a connection why chapter 21 shows up here. And here's a very creative suggestion made by Rabbi Yosef Bechorshor, who was probably a younger contemporary and perhaps a student of Rashi's grandson, Rashbam. Those of you who know me know that Rashbam will show up frequently in the classes that I teach. I don't think he's going to show up today, except as being the older friend and perhaps teacher of Rabbi Yosef Bechorshor. And Yosef Bechorshor suggests that actually chapter 21 and following, the civil laws here are not a continuation of chapter 20, which is the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And chapter 19 was just the lead up to the Ten Commandments of the people coming and standing at Mount Sinai in order to be able to hear the laws coming from God. Bechorshor writes, according to the Pshat, since Moses had appointed judges, chiefs of thousands and hundreds, that's back in chapter 18, the beginning of Parashat Yitro, Exodus chapter 18 is the story of Jethro coming and seeing that Moshe was trying to judge the people on his own. And Jethro said, you can't run a system like this. You have to have a system of judges. And they set up a system of judges with chiefs of thousands and chiefs of hundreds. God said to him, wow, now that you have appointed judges, here are the laws that you should place before those judges, or perhaps here are the cases that you should place before those judges. In other words, that chapters 21 and 22 and following are a logical continuation of chapter 18 of Exodus, which was the suggestion of Yitro that they set up a system of adjudication for the people who are for the Israelites in the desert, that Moshe was asked to set up a system of judges. And now, how are the judges going to make their decisions? Now the laws are being presented here so that the judges will be able to make their decisions. That's Yosef Bechorshor's suggestion. Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, who was younger than Yosef before Shor, and who lived in Christian Spain and came here to the land of Israel towards the end of his life, he offers another suggestion. The reason why this whole section dealing with Mishpatim, civil laws, is placed at the beginning of all the Torah's laws is, there are going to be a lot of laws. We all know there are 613 mitzvot, 613 commandments. Why did they start off with rules of the goring ox and the rules of torts and rules of civil procedure? Why is this placed at the beginning of all the Torah's laws? He says, the first of the Ten Commandments dealt with the obligation of knowing of the existence of God. And the second one with the prohibition against idolatry. After that, God again instructed Moses, saying, thus shall you say to the Israelites, you yourself saw that I spoke to you from the very heavens, meaning that you, Moses, should warn them again to take to heart that which they saw, so that they will be careful to keep these precepts which I commanded them. So, in other words, what we suggested before was first suggested by Ramban, or earlier suggested by Ramban, at the end of chapter 20, before we get to chapter 21, to our text here, is an expansion of the first and second commandments. And it goes on, you yourself saw corresponds to the commandment, I am the Lord your God. With me, therefore, you shall not make any gods of silver, corresponds with Lo yelecha Elohim achirim lepanah, you shall have no other gods. Thereby completing the subject of idolatry. And then he says, Ve'ele hamishpatim keneged lo tachmod. Likewise, these are the laws corresponds to you shall not covet. That all of the, so many of the laws that we will be seeing here in the covenant code are stories of disagreements between human beings. And where do disagreements between human beings come from? They come from coveting. They come from the fact that you have something and I don't have it, and I wish that I had it. And that's the source of all of the problems. And so Ramban is adopting a way of understanding our text that other commentators also followed, and suggesting that all of the laws that we are going to be seeing are in a certain sense an expansion on the Ten Commandments. And he's suggesting that most of them are here in the section that we will be studying is an expansion on the commandment of not coveting. Okay, so that's Ramban's suggestion. Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries on the book of Exodus. The cynics say that Ibn Ezra, he wrote his first commentary on the book of Exodus when he was living in Italy, and then he moved to France and he wrote a second commentary. The cynics say that the reason that Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries is because they were willing to pay him in France to write a commentary on Exodus. And so instead of saying, well, actually, I already wrote a commentary on Exodus back in Italy, and I could just show that to you, he accepted a grant from the granting agency or from the patron who was willing to support him. And that's why he wrote another commentary. I used to be attracted to the cynical understanding of Ibn Ezra, but I now understand that people change their mind about the understanding of a text. And now that I'm, I guess, around as old as Ibn Ezra was, or maybe a little older than Ibn Ezra was when he wrote a second commentary on Exodus. And, you know, do I agree with everything? You know, when I pick up a book that I wrote in the 1980s, my first volume of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, I can tell you my hands are shaking when I open it up, because I say to myself, what kind of foolishness did I think back in the 1980s? What did I write in this book? Sometimes I say, oh, that wasn't so bad. And sometimes I feel embarrassed. So you change your mind, and People talk about the fact that that in the Middle Ages, there was a concept of, some scholars call it the concept of the open book, that, you write a book and it's not closed after you write it. It's somewhat like the internet, where you write something on the internet. My translation of Rashbam on the Torah can be found on the website called alatorah.org. And the scholar who runs that website is called Hill Novetsky, lives a few blocks away from me here in Jerusalem. He's a good friend of mine. He's a wonderful, wonderful scholar. And I've gotten in touch with him a couple of times, and I've said to him, can I change my translation? Because I've changed my mind about what that actually means. And Hillel says to me, that's the beauty of the internet. You just tell me what you want the translation to be now, and we'll change it. And so the printing of books really freezes a text. But when there are manuscripts only, and there's a limited number of manuscripts while Ibn Ezra is alive, or while Rashbam is alive, and so he can tell people to change what's written there in the text. So I don't think that it's so terrible that Ibn Ezra wrote two commentaries on the book of Exodus. And just for didactic reasons, I decided to start with a second commentary here. After the Israelites said to Moses, "You speak to us," God said to Moses when he approached the thick cloud, "Thus shall you say to the Israelites." Moses began by warning about God's goal and told them that he would have them enter into a covenant that the Lord alone was their God when he came back down from Mount Sinai. What Ibn Ezra is doing here is actually connecting the covenant code here, the laws here of chapter 21, 22, and 23 with Exodus chapter 24, which describes a covenant that God makes with the Israelites. And so Ibn Ezra says that God said to Moses, before I make a covenant with them, I want them to know about these rules. God taught Moses the laws and mitzvot that he should tell them, that if they accept those rules and mitzvot, God will then enter into a covenant with them. So what is this text doing here? It is actually part of the, I talked about the continuing historical narrative that began in Bereishit, that began in the beginning of Genesis, and it continued until chapter 20 with the Ten Commandments. And then we have these laws here. Ibn Ezra says that's part of the continuing narrative, because at the end of these laws, it's going to say that Moshe is going to say to the people, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord is making with you regarding all of these words, regarding all of these laws. And so that's a really interesting idea that Ibn Ezra is presenting here, that having a system of civil laws like this, of interpersonal relationships, the way that people will resolve disputes between themselves is a condition of the covenant that God wants to make with the Jewish people. And so God taught Moshe all these mitzvot. He'll tell them that if you accept these mitzvot, and at the end in chapter 24, they say, Kol asher diber Hashem naaseh, okay, we'll do whatever God said. And Ibn Ezra is saying that that refers to all of these civil laws, that these are the condition on which the covenant is going to be made in chapter 24. In his first commentary on Exodus, Ibn Ezra went in a different direction. He writes, before I begin to write a commentary on this parasha, when medieval Jews used the word parasha, sometimes, occasionally, it meant Torah portion, as we talk about in Parashat HaShavua, but more often than not, it just meant a section of text, this section of text. So before I start commenting on this section of text, I'll set down a general rule. Each mitzvah and law has independent status. but there are also some hints of connection between the verse. It's hard to translate that Hebrew there of Ibn Ezra. Those of you who can look at the Hebrew. Gam yesh kidmut smach lehidabik hapsukim. Maybe there is some kind of connection. In another place, Ibn Ezra writes, you know, when I can tell you that this law followed that law for the following reason, I'll do so. And when I can't, I'll just say, gee, I'm not as smart as other people, and I can't figure out why. So he wanted to limit the amount of energy that people would expend on the question of why the laws fall in a certain order. But he also, like many people, even Ezra wants to have his cake and eat it too. He'd like to criticize people for reading too much into the connection between various laws, and he'd like to do it from time to time. And here he makes a really interesting suggestion. Ha'ikar, the important principle, the most important principle perhaps, is that people should not oppress others and force someone weaker than them. And so the text begins with laws about the force involved in enslaving a slave. Ibn Ezra is arguing, I think it's a very nice argument, that the Torah is a primary concern, maybe the primary concern of the Torah is that people should not oppress each other, that people should be nice to each other, that people should not harass and abuse the people who are weaker than them. And because of that, the laws began here specifically with the laws of slavery. Okay, we'll talk about the fact that slavery just being the worst kind of example of oppressing others and forcing someone weaker than them to do something. But Ibn Ezra is saying the limitations that the Torah is putting on slavery are the way that the Torah makes the point that the most important principle is that people should not harass each other, should not oppress each other, and should not force people who are weaker than they are. Two more approaches to this question of the order here in which the laws appear. Here's from Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman in Germany in the beginning of the 20th century. After the Torah provided five laws that have to do with the respect that is due to God, we find now mitzvot that correspond to the second tablet of the Decalogue. Laws whose purpose is to regulate interpersonal relationships and establish civil and social norms that will make both society and the state safe. So Hoffman, a modern man living in early 20th century Germany, says that right after the Decalogue, what do we find? First of all, laws that regulate the worship of God. And second, and then after that, laws that regulate interpersonal relationships and establish civil and social norms that will make our society safe and our state safe. And one last suggestion about this. Some of you who have studied with me before know that I've recently developed a true affection for the commentary of Samuel David Luzzatto, Shadal, who lived in Italy in the beginning of the 19th century. A friend of mine here in Jerusalem, who like me is very interested in Rashbam's commentary on the Torah, told me that her husband said to her recently, "It appears to me that you are not being as faithful to Rashbam as you used to be, and you're now flirting with Chagall very often. And she said to me, that was true. My husband was right. I have discovered that Chagall's commentary on the Torah has a lot of, yes, and I plead guilty to the same thing that, you know, I still, Rashbam was my first love, but I do have a lot of love for Chagall's commentary on the Torah. And he was a much more modern person with values that are, in fact, closer to the values that we live by now in the 21st century. So he writes, Mishpat is a noun formed from a verb, shafat, to judge. And it means the decision of law that a judge decrees. You know, before in the translation of Yosef Bechor Shor, I wasn't quite sure what he meant when he was using the word mishpatim. Did he mean the laws, or did he mean the decisions that a judge makes? So Luzzatto comes down and says, mishpat refers to the decisions that a judge makes. He goes on, do not commit murder, do not commit adultery, and do not steal are not mishpatim. Rather, they are crucial root principles that people do not need to learn from a judge, for everyone acknowledges them. The Ten Commandments has various principles in them. You don't need to go to a court of law for somebody to tell you that you should be refraining from stealing and that you should be refraining from committing adultery. These are root principles. These are ideas that on which the Torah depends. On the other hand, the laws that appear in this section are branches. He calls them anafim. You know, these are things that branch out from the root principles of not killing and not stealing. But we get to these laws that are subject to dispute, concerning which people need a judge to decide the law, and that's why they are called mishpatim. So I really like this this explanation that the Torah in chapter 20 gave the basic principles that, as Chagall says, do not require a judge. They're principles that are acknowledged by all people. But now we get into the section, to give one example, a law that we'll see in a few weeks when we get to it. If I have an ox and you have an ox and our oxen are out in a field somewhere and my ox gores your ox, well, there are a number of possibilities. You could say, well, that's what oxen do. And you could say, well, there's no responsibility of the owner of the goring ox. And you could also say, what do you mean? Your ox hurt my ox. You have to pay me. Or you could say, as the Torah says, as we will see, well, in a situation like this, you pay half damages. That's what the Torah says. These are things about which one could dispute. And so you need to have a law code. You can say, don't harm each other, don't steal from each other, don't kill each other, don't swear falsely about each other. Those are fine principles, but then you get down to the nitty-gritty and you could have arguments about it. And now the Torah is getting down to the nitty-gritty, is what Chagall is saying. Okay. I think we do have time, I think, to read two more comments of Rashi on the opening verse of Parshat Mishpatim. These are the rules. These are the Mishpatim, the laws, the decrees, the judgments, however you want to translate Mishpatim, which you shall put before them. God said to Moshe, do not think of saying, I shall teach them a section of the Torah twice or three times until it will become fluent in their mouths verbatim. But I shall not take the trouble to make them understand the reason of each thing and its significance. Therefore, scripture says, which you shall put before them like a table fully laid, he uses the phrase, Shulchan Aruch, which later became, of course, the famous work of Jewish law written by Rabbi Joseph Carroll, like a table fully laid in front of a person with everything ready for eating. Okay, so the requirement to teach in such a way that people won't just know the details, but they will understand the ideas behind it. That's comment number one of Rashi about Asher Tasim Lifnehem. And then he gives you another comment before them, but not before the Gentiles. Even if you know concerning one particular issue that they would rule in the same way as Jewish law would, do not bring it before their courts. For he who brings Israel's law cases before the heathens desecrates the name of God and pays honor to the name of the idol. Rashi is suggesting here that this phrase, Asher Tasim Lifnehem, means you should always bring your legal cases for adjudication to a Beit Din, to a Jewish religious court, and you shall not bring it to a non-Jewish court. Many of you will know that this is still in some religious circles. This is considered to be an important religious principle that if two Jews have a dispute with each other, they should bring that dispute before a Beit Din, and they shouldn't go to a court in the province of Ontario or in the state of New York to adjudicate their dispute. Particularly in the days of Rashi, you can understand the vehemence with which Rashi writes about this issue, because in Rashi's court, in Rashi's days, there were no courts that were secular courts. The courts were either Jewish courts or Christian courts. And so if two Jews have a dispute with each other, then they have to decide, am I going to have somebody who's motivated by Jewish principles adjudicating this case, or somebody who's motivated by Christian principles adjudicating this case? Perhaps now I will just throw out a question to you, because we're almost at the time for opening up for comments. Does anybody notice something strange about the relationship between these two comments of Rashi here that appear one after the other in the text of Rashi's commentary? If somebody would like to unmute herself, himself, and answer, feel free to do so. Or if somebody wants to write a comment in the chat about what the difference is between these two, Yes, somebody suggests what happens if the Jews belong to different competing Hasidic sects or other and they want home court advantage. Yes, that is a big problem.
It seems like he's contradicting himself. Usually if Rashi, I would think that if Rashi says, you know, this word means this in this context, then that's what it means. And here he's giving two different things that it means.
That's right. And which words is he interpreting in two different ways that are, I would argue, non-compatible? Which words are being interpreted in two different ways?
Asher Tasim Lifnehem.
Right. And of those three words, which ones in particular?
Lifnehem.
Lifnehem. Okay, good. First of all, there are two entirely different understandings of Lifnehem. In the first paragraph here, Rashi is saying that Lifnehem means the Jews who you are teaching the laws. When you are teaching the laws, teach them to the Jews very well. Tasim Lifnehem, in front of the Jewish students of the law, the people to whom you are teaching the laws, you should teach it to them in a way that that will help them understand it. And then at the second comment, Lifnehem means Jewish, before Jewish courts, not before Jewish students, but before Jewish courts. But there's actually, when you think about it, there's another one of those words that Rashi is interpreting in two different non-compatible ways. Does anybody see which other word of Rashi, of this verse Rashi is interpreting in two different non-compatible ways?
The word maybe tassim?
Yes, very good. Who said
one says place that? It means teach, and the other place it means bring for judgment.
That's right. Very good. So does tassim mean to teach, or does it mean to bring for judgment? And I would argue further that the taf in tassim is interpreted by Rashi in two different non-compatible ways. In the first paragraph, tassim is, the taf of tassim is, you, Moses, when you are teaching the Israelites, you should teach them in such a way that they will understand it. And in the second understanding, tassim means you, the individual Jew who had a dispute with another Jew, you should tassim, you should put that dispute before a Jewish court. So in those three words, asher tassim lifneihem, Rashi is offering two different understandings of lifneihem, two different understandings of sim, and two different understandings of the taf. Why is Rashi doing this? Well, I noticed that in the beginning of the class, I had noticed that, yes, Shalom, you're still with us. Wonderful to see you here. Shalom Eisenstadt's daughter wrote a wonderful doctoral dissertation about Rashi's commentary on the Torah, in which she argued and proved my satisfaction, and I think the satisfaction of everybody who reads it, that Rashi's primary purpose is not to explain the Torah. In some circles, this sounds like heresy to say this, but I hope that I'm in a safe place here in Torah in Motion. And aside from that, I'm just quoting it in Yedida Eisenstadt's name, and I'm not saying it in my own name. His purpose was to be a Jewish educator. And these are two Jewish messages that he wants to get across. One of them is that when you teach, you shouldn't just have people memorize the text. They should understand the text. They should understand what the idea is in the text. And the second principle is that Jews should be bringing their disputes to Jewish adjudication and not to Christian adjudication. And Rashi found both of these explanations of the text in earlier, he didn't make up either one of these. Yedida Eisenstadt argues in her doctoral dissertation that Rashi is a compiler of Midrashim, and he's writing an anthology of Midrashim, and he liked both of these Midrashim. Both of them promoted a point that Rashi thought was worth promoting, and that I'll tell you, I also think was worth promoting. Okay, I think that I will stop here. I'll see if there are any questions here in the chat to deal with, and if anybody wants to unmute themselves, please feel free to do the one interpretation. Zahav iPad says, one interpretation looks at the Torah as a history book. The second is more post-temple, making the Torah more relevant for a post-temple, post-prophet world, speaking to that and future generations, not primarily as history. Okay, very good. A good understanding. Any other comments or questions that people would like to share? Okay, it was wonderful seeing you.
Thank you.
I'll see you next week. And Shira, do you want to make the announcement, or should I make the announcement that in a mere hour from now, you can hear another class from Torah in Motion by Rabbi Moshe Shulman, who some of you may remember as having been the rabbi of Shaar Shamayim Synagogue in Toronto many years ago, and is now the rabbi of a synagogue in St. Louis, I think the Young Israel of St. Louis, not 100% certain. And he will be teaching about the Midrash approach 1 hour from now.
I have also just put a link into the chat that is a sign up for all the programs that we're running. There's 10 classes running in the spring series, so you can copy that link and take a look at all the other wonderful offerings. And otherwise, we will look forward to seeing you all here next week, same time, same bat channel.
Very good.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thank you so much, Dr. Nachshon. This was wonderful.
And a
very important message from Ronit before we leave as well.
Thank you, Ronit.
Everybody, to light a Yahrzeit candle tonight. Good memories to everybody. And never again. Never again. Never forget. Never again.
Amen. Right.
Amen.
My wife and I are off to a Yom HaShoah activity right now.
Yeah. Okay. The Sorah Tikvah. All the best, everybody.
All the best to all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lakshin.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.